You're listening to FemMonk. I'm your host, Katie Davey, and I'm on a mission to raise the policy conversation around gender and inclusion. This week, we're going to be talking about basic income. And I'm actually shocked that we're on episode 30, and it will be the first time that we've actually dived into basic income. When I was first conceptualizing FemMonk, I created a list of topics I wanted to talk about, and basic income was actually on that list. I looked back at that list before recording this episode, and we've covered most of the topics that I would have outlined. And that's kind of interesting, considering it was about a year ago when we created that list. The title of the actual note is Feminist Social Policy Podcast, so I feel like we've tried to stay true to that vision, so I'm happy with where we're at in episode 30. I guess while we're going down nostalgia lane, I'm really happy to let you know that FemLink has been named one of the top 15 gender equality podcasts by FeedSpot. As we kick off our 30th episode, I really could not be more excited and proud of the product that we've been creating. So thank you so much for folks who've been along for the journey. And if you're new, welcome to episode 30. Okay, basic income. So first, what is it? Well, basic income currently goes by many names, and there is some distinction among them. So universal basic income, which is often just referred to as UBI. There's guaranteed basic income, guaranteed minimum income, basic income guarantee, and a bit more colloquially here in Canada, you'll hear of MINCOME, which was based on a pilot project in Manitoba in the 70s. There's also the Freedom Dividend, which is the way that U.S. presidential candidate Andrew Yang has branded his core platform plank, which is just UBI. So although there are many names for basic income, the general principle is the same. And basically, that principle is that basic income is generally seen as a payment from the government to a person to ensure that they're receiving a minimum level of income. And of course, minimum level of income is a little bit subjective, but that is by and large what we're talking about. And it is different from your traditional kind of social assistance model that we're used to here in Canada for basically two reasons. One, it is administered to anyone who meets the income eligibility criteria widely. And it is also, because of that, quite a bit simpler to administer than your general social assistance program. One of the biggest criticisms, of course, of social assistance programs are kind of one, all of the hoops you have to jump through basically to actually get the funding, and two, all of the kind of criteria and regulation that is built in around those programs that actually end up making it incredibly hard to get out of that social assistance trap, as they sometimes call it. So by and large, basic income, again, given to anybody who meets the eligibility criteria, and because of that, much simpler to administer. There are a few different ways that basic income can be implemented, and this is really where the kind of nuances come from in the naming. So there is a bit of a difference between universal and a guaranteed basic income. So universal, obviously, would be a mechanism where every single person would get the same amount. And this is very much what Andrew Yang's platform commitment in the US is built off of. He is advocating for a universal basic income of every United States citizen would receive $1,000 a month. And you could, if you didn't, were a millionaire or even just upper middle class, you have the ability to opt out of the program. So then you wouldn't get that $1,000, but it would be an opt out process. The other kind of two ways that you'll see basic incomes talked about and conceived is a topping up of the income of people who are earning less than a certain threshold amount. So say, let's just use that Yang example. Say you determined the kind of certain amount of basic income you wanted to give out was $1,000 a month, and somebody was making, say, $500 a month, you would top that up to $1,000 a month. And the third way is essentially kind of setting up a system where people who, again, would earn less than a certain threshold would get a payment from the government instead of paying taxes. So say, for example, you said the overall rate of basic income we want to go off of is $12,000 a year. So again, using the Yang example, if you're giving somebody $1,000 a month, that'd be $12,000 a year. So if you don't hit $12,000 a year, say you end up making $10,000 a year, we'll give you the additional $2,000. So there are, of course, nuances among these different kind of options for sure. And honestly, you might be thinking to yourself right now, like, okay, well, why would we do this anyways? Like, why basic income? Or maybe you're thinking on the opposite end, like, yeah, this just makes lots of sense to me. Why aren't we doing it? And I'm going to hopefully answer both of those questions as we kind of chat through this episode. But I think really there seems to still be a lot of stigmatization around basic income. It's a little bit ironic because one of the key characteristics and benefits of a basic income would be reducing stigmatization for those needing access to a form of social assistance. But I honestly talk about basic income like literally whenever I can. You can ask basically anyone who spends any amount of time with me and they will tell you that I'm just like a broken record talking about basic income. So I have definitely, in many cases, encountered folks who, who don't really get it. And I think fundamentally the reason that some folks have a hard time grasping the rationalization behind basic income is because, you know, we have a socially constructed view of work and prosperity in the Western world that really centers around capitalism. And I think capitalism has created a system where we measure a person's value by their ability to contribute to the traditional labor market. And that's flawed for many, many reasons, in my opinion. A perfect example of this actually is women's unpaid care work. So McKinsey actually put out a report that stated that women's unpaid work supports $10 trillion, with a T, dollars of GDP or gross domestic product worldwide per year. And yet these women are receiving no true economic benefits, as I just said, right? We're measuring their value through economic prosperity, even though this unpaid care work worldwide is contributing, supporting rather, $10 trillion to the GDP. These women are not receiving any sort of economic benefit. So to me, that actually shows that our system does not at all value that work. So that is an issue to me. And, you know, most of what we've just talked about really is income, but basic income, even though it says income in the word, basic income doesn't just consider income, actually. And a lot of people, I think, have a negative view, perhaps, because they're scared of this mass exodus from the labor market, from rather the traditional labor market. But there's literally no research to suggest that that would be the case. In any pilot that has been run with basic income, that is not seen to be the case. There is, however, some research to suggest that folks maybe will stay in school a little bit longer. Parents might stay at home with their child a little bit longer. And people are not necessarily being forced into taking jobs that are not meaningful. But that being said, you know, when you create a basic income program, the idea is not to move folks out of the traditional labor market at all, but rather support folks in whatever situation that they're in. And I think we need to also be talking about how the market is changing and how basic income can support that change. You know, we hear every day about how AI and automation are making jobs obsolete. And really, you know, all you've got to do is head to Walmart or McDonald's and see this in action at really the most basic level. But, you know, these changes are showing no signs of slowing down, and that will continue to displace workers along the way. So a basic income really could also support that mechanism, right? That transition. And yeah, you know, I said basic income is not just about income. And that's really true. When folks are kind of creating these pilot programs for basic income, they're measuring in many cases much more than just kind of income, level of poverty. They're measuring lots of other types of social benefits. And for example, in the recent pilot project in Ontario, they planned to measure a number of things and how the basic income pilot contributed to those. So for example, food security, stress and anxiety, mental health, health and healthcare usage, housing stability, education and training, and of course, employment and labor market participation. So I think those are really important things. And in the Finland study, actually, that is fairly recent, there is a decrease in stress. There's a measurable decrease in stress for those who participated in the pilot. So I think we need to push beyond just this economic argument, while also recognizing, of course, that there is undoubtedly an economic argument and impact here. Whew. Let me take a breath. This is the one thing when you get straight Katie, I will just go and go and go and go and not take a breath and stop and breathe. So particularly when I'm as passionate about a topic as basic income. Okay, so I've mentioned now a couple of pilots overall, and I just want to talk a bit about those pilots. So I just mentioned the Ontario pilot. So that is a very recent pilot here in Canada. So the Ontario government in 2016 announced that they would be doing a basic income pilot project. And they had actually a really significant system set up for robust monitoring and evaluation, as well as, you know, on the front end when they were developing this pilot, they took a really methodological approach and built out really, I think, an excellent program. And they were really able to do this based on actually the guidance and recommendations of former Senator Hugh Segal, who is really one of the thought leaders in Canada actually on basic income. And he's a conservative, was a conservative senator. So, you know, I think we often think about basic income as a bit of a leftist or progressive, quote unquote, policy. But really, there are lots of folks on all ends of the spectrum doing this work. And like I said, this full Ontario pilot really was built out based on the recommendations of former Senator Hugh Segal. So I would highly recommend, if you're interested overall in basic income and in kind of the, I don't know, mechanics of it, to check out how Ontario set up their pilot. It really was quite good. And the model that they used was that universal model. In Canada, there's also the Mincome Project, which I mentioned at the beginning of the episode. It has kind of that fun colloquial name to it. It is really, I think, widely known, particularly in Manitoba. But that was, again, one of the really first examples of a pilot. And as, you know, things happen, governments changed, pilots changed. But again, this was really, really an interesting study when you look now back in hindsight. And this is actually where you saw some really transformational stats on people staying in school longer, you know, mothers being able to stay at home with their children a bit longer upon birth. And also, if I actually remember correctly, I recently was listening to an expert talk about how they also saw a decrease in visits to the healthcare system in kind of the emergency space. I think that one's a little bit harder to measure, but again, a really concrete example of some of the benefits that you see. Also mentioned Finland. I feel like I mentioned all of these already. They just are sprinkled in. But anyways, Finland just recently wrapped up their pilot. And like I mentioned earlier, the two things that I think were really transformational, about that pilot was they recorded no market difference in labor participation, which in this case is a good thing. That means they did not see folks exit the labor market, but they did, however, see a decrease in stress. So, you know, virtually no change in labor market, but a reduced level of stress among the folks participating. In this past provincial election in PEI, the Green Party had a commitment to a basic income pilot in their platform, and then, you know, folks who've been following along with the lovely rise in minority governments in Canada will know that in PEI, it is a conservative government right now, but the conservative government is in a minority situation propped up by, in a very weird way, both the Green Party and the Liberals, depending on the issue. So I think that's interesting, and kind of keeping my eye on what happens there, because I think PEI is, you know, small enough that they could very easily implement a pilot, or rather not even a pilot, they could implement something that actually impacts their entire population. And they could also do this in partnership with the federal government. I think that's really one of the conversations that's missing a little bit in Canada is, you know, when the provinces start to try to do these pilots, if they don't have the support of the federal government, a lot of the money flowing through for social assistance programs in the provinces actually comes through money from the federal government. So I think that's really important. So I think this is one to watch. I'll have my eye on PEI to see if they end up getting any movement on this and see kind of how they might perhaps work with a federal government to implement a real kind of meaningful partnership. And the other person I've been keeping my eye on is Andrew Yang. He is a U.S. Democratic presidential candidate. He started his campaign literally running just on this idea of universal basic income. That is like the only thing he was running on. And he has consistently gained traction. He is an outsider in every sense of the word, politically. And yeah, he just keeps gaining traction. He was on the debate stage in September, one of only 10 that hit the kind of criteria. So I think it's really exciting. And actually, what I think is so interesting is it seems that the kind of cohort that is really attaching themselves to Yang and to his message is kind of the millennials broadly, but I would say really the kind of under 40-ish crowd. And I think that's really important because I think those types of folks is folks kind of in and around my demographic who are so interested in how we redefine social programs and really redefine the economy in a way that will work moving forward for, you know, for us to kind of go through the system in a way that is comfortable and predictable and a little bit secure. I don't know if that's a reasonable request, but I think that is very much something that we are seeing with Yang. Okay. We're in the federal election period right now. Talked a lot about provincial pilot programs. Talked a lot about just the landscape, what is basic income, all that fun stuff. But the next question is, what the heck are the federal parties saying on it? So as far as I could tell, I combed through all of the party platforms and, you know, did some reasoning about what parties might identify with this issue. And then also recognize that not all parties have released their full platform, but in the cases where they haven't, I looked through their kind of current announcements and made a bit of an analysis there. But as it stands right now, we have the Green Party and the NDP who actually have wording of basic income pilots in their platforms. And then we have the Liberal Party who is weirdly using this like guaranteed income, basic income kind of language without using it in relation to, you know, a basic income kind of pilot or a guaranteed basic income. So I'm going to just take a few minutes to go over what the parties are saying and provide a bit of an analysis there. So in the Green Party platform, guaranteed basic income, or rather, I believe they use, basic income security. They reference it in two sections, but one basically references it to the other. The other thing that I find really interesting about the Green Party platform is they've actually like partnered every single one of their sections with a sustainable development goal. So the first section that they talk about basic income is in the section called The World of Work, and they partner that with SDG 8, which is Decent Work and Economic Growth. And they talk basically, really their full language here is essentially like responding to automation, we'll need to do something. And their proposals are working with provinces, territories, and Indigenous people to establish a guaranteed livable income to provide basic income security, for all, including displaced workers, and then they have brackets C, ending poverty. So they very much again, see this idea of basic income helping to address the disruption in the labor force. They also reference it again in another section, like you just said, called Ending Poverty, and they tie ending poverty with SDG number one, which is called Ending Poverty. And they really dig in here and talk a bit about, so the language they use, research has demonstrated that programs providing a universal basic income reduce expenditures on healthcare, since poverty is the single largest determinant of ill health and the justice system, and increase school retention. Well, so that's not a real sentence, I guess, so somebody should maybe tell them that. But, so they, again, really see this as a way of also addressing poverty. In their announcement, they talked a bit about the costing and things like that, and the way that they framed it was a little bit weird, but it was kind of like, I think, if I understood what they were saying, which, again, it was framed a little bit weird, there would be no, they would determine their rate of basic income, and then there would be no tax on that portion of the income. So again, let's go back to the $1,000 a month model, say $12,000, there would be no tax on the $12,000. But then after that, you would start being taxed, or there would start being a clawback. So again, that's interesting. And really, this is an incredibly bold proposal. They're going all in and saying, you know, basic income security for all. So that's big. We'll see what happens. I don't think we think the Green Party is going to be forming government anytime soon, but if things continue to go the way that they're going, there's a very real possibility they will hold some sort of power in a perhaps minority situation. So I think that's really interesting. And then the NDP ties their basic income again directly to tackling poverty. So the wording they use is the New Democrats will work with the provinces to launch a national basic income pilot project in addition to continuing Ontario's program in order to gather data about this approach to tackling income precarity. Can't say that word. Developing a national public universal child care program is also critical for lifting women and their families out of poverty and is an important way to give all of our kids a good start to learning. So yeah, they are very much looking at this universal basic income as a way of tackling and addressing poverty, which, don't get me wrong, absolutely is. But I think that's pretty narrow-minded. And I just honestly am a little bit sick of hearing about pilots. Like I just mentioned to you, at least three pilots, and those are just like off top of my head that have happened recently or in the Canadian context. So we have data. We don't need to keep doing these pilots. So it's a little bit frustrating that that's kind of the soft language, but at the same time, at least they're talking about it. As I mentioned, the LPC is using words like guaranteed income, like basic income, etc., but they're not using it in the same way. So they have used it twice so far in the campaign, one in relation to parental leave. So they use the language, moving towards a vision for guaranteed paid family leave for everybody. So what they're basically saying is, so right now maternity and parental leave benefits happen through unemployment insurance, which means like any sort of unemployment insurance, you have to maintain, or you have to hit the threshold, right? So you have to work for a certain amount of time and have a certain amount of hours to actually take that benefit. So, you know, for folks, for example, who are self-employed or maybe are working kind of part-time or have, you know, stretched out their working kind of relationship, or, you know, who have kind of stretched out their employment relationship, or maybe are just honestly having a second kid fairly soon, they actually just can't access maternity benefits. So their stat that they use here is 1 in 6 mothers in Canada's workforce does not receive paid family leave despite having worked before their child was born. So that's like a pretty hefty number. And I think this is a very good policy But I think it's very odd, again, to be using words like guaranteed income and kind of guaranteed benefits. They also use the same language with the guaranteed income supplement for seniors, which, to be fair, the name of the program is guaranteed income supplement. But I think the LPC and actually broadly the Liberal government has kind of started to use this language. So they talk, when they talk about the Canada Child Benefit, they kind of say, well, this is a basic income for children. And then they have, you know, when they talk about seniors, they have increases to the CPP and increases to the GIS, and they see that as a basic income for seniors. And now they're layering on this, you know, basic income for mothers for maternity leave. So I find it odd that they're using this language, but they're not using it in the way that people use guaranteed basic income language. So my fingers are crossed that this is kind of paving the way for an actual real meaningful commitment on a basic income broadly. But yeah, I think it's interesting. I think it's interesting that they're using the language, and I think it's, I'm fingers crossed that it'll be a bigger commitment. I was unable to find commitments, however, on a basic income in any kind of platform or documents for the Conservative Party, for the People's Party of Canada, and for the Bloc Québécois. Not surprising, but sad. So, okay, I've dumped on you some history, some pilots, what the heck is it, what parties are doing, and I'm sure, like many, you're sitting there saying, so Katie, how might we pay for this? And I would say, great question, thanks for asking. So actually, kind of hilariously enough, the Parliamentary Budget Office did a costing of a national program that uses the model of the Ontario program just recently, and they did this actually at the request of Pierre Poilievre, Conservative MP. And I think it is a little bit funny that he requested this and obviously requested it to use it as kind of ammunition for when inevitably the more left-leaning parties started to talk about basic income. Essentially, there are lots of numbers. This report was, you know, kind of 15 pages long. So they identified with their model, that model, that the cost of a guaranteed basic income in, if it were to be implemented in 2018-19, would cost $76 billion. But then they did this kind of, you know, workaround math. They pulled out essentially people who are already getting a basic income. So like the GIS, old age security, CP, Canada Child Benefit, rather. They pulled those out because those folks are already getting essentially guaranteed basic income. And they've kind of reduced that number to about $32 billion. But then they do make this claim, which I actually think is really incredibly important. They basically say that, you know, guaranteed basic income could be combined federal-provincial basic income system with an intergovernmental arrangement, which is very common for programs. And if that were to happen, this would replace some of the kind of provincial transfers for low-income individuals, and also you would be able to leverage a bit the money that that provinces are spending on these types of programs. So that's why I talked a little bit about in the PEI example why it'd be really interesting to see what that federal-provincial partnership could look like. So that being said, I think the number is really big, and like I said, you know, Pierre Poilievre is the one who requested the data, so he wants to throw that number around as much as he can, but it actually doesn't really cost, I mean, yes, that is a lot of money, but in the grand scheme of things, if we were to able to actually, like, really define a good, solid program that reduced duplication, made it easier for people to access, etc., it would not be that much money, and you could pretty easily pay for something like this with just a moderate, or rather a modest tax increase on the 1%. The other model, actually, and this is how Andrew Yang is saying he would pay for it, is he's basically saying, look, you've got all these tech giants, and you've got all these tech giants, rather, that are benefiting financially off of our data. They should be taxed for that. And so that's actually how he's proposing to pay for his program in the US, which I don't think is a bad idea, actually, like to say, yeah, anyways, this is going to be a long episode already. I'm not going to get into that. But I think that that is an interesting piece of the puzzle. There also is, as I mentioned when talking about what some of the social benefits here are, there is a bit of a cost avoidance, right? If you see a decrease in folks visiting the healthcare system, if you see a decrease in folks in the criminal justice system, that is going to be money that, you know, is perhaps available for repurposing. That being said, the lovely deputy minister of the Department of Health in New Brunswick used to always tell me when I came to him with my big ideas about cost savings, he would often remind me, Katie, in the healthcare system, there's no such thing as cost savings, rather cost avoidance. So that is definitely a thing, and I don't think we should discount it. But I think if there is a will to do this, there would be a way to pay for it. That is really brewed in a principle of fundamental human rights and fundamental kind of justice and equity. So I think that that is what we should do. Last but not least, we took some questions from Instagram on this topic, which I am super jazzed about, and I would love to know your thoughts on if we should continue to do that. So I'm just going to actually pull them up here. I haven't prepared any answers on them, so let's see how I do. Okay, so the first question, why are some people in the labor movement against basic income? So great question. I actually haven't really heard that myself, but I'm sure it is possibly out there. If I had to guess, I would say it really is rooted in the fact that the labor movement, and I would say more broadly organized labor organizations, they have a duty to protect their members' jobs, right? And so I think their first principle is protecting jobs and protecting, you know, good, well-paying jobs. So as I mentioned a few times in the episode, there is a bit of hesitancy around a basic income promoting an exodus in the labor market. Like I said, there's no research to suggest that, but I'm sure that that is perhaps where there may be some, I guess, some rooted skepticism for sure. How can you regulate it so it's not used as a campaign tool? Also, a very good question. I think that it is not yet mainstream enough for it to be used as a campaign tool. But that being said, many provinces are moving towards a model where campaign platforms have to be fully costed. So I think that is a way, right? Like if you have to provide a costing of this commitment, then, you know, you can, there's a bit more accountability within it. So I think that would really be a huge thing. How sustainable is the idea? Well, I think it really, again, depends on how you set it up. You know, in Alaska, actually, there's a basic income, and it's more of a dividend, I guess. So what they've done, basically, they took the money from their resource development and invested it in a way that it provides a dividend for every citizen of Alaska, which I think is an incredible model, and a model that perhaps we as Canadians should have adopted at the turn of our energy boom, and we might not be in the place we're in right now. So I think that is not necessarily exactly applicable to this situation, but I think it's all about how you set up the system, right? It can't be a vision of a four-year re-election. It has to be baked in some of those overall systemic changes that provide a real meaningful, sustainable solution. And the final question we are going to answer today is a personal favorite of mine, which is why literally anyone on earth thinks it is a bad idea. And you know what? I don't actually have an answer to that question. I've shown my bias. I think a basic income is something we need to be having a meaningful conversation on, and about rather. And I think that when we dig into the details, we are going to see that it is a great idea that solves many, not solves necessarily, but that addresses many challenges that we're facing. And also, I think when we really get down to it, we need to have a conversation about what our goals are as a society. Are our goals just literally to grow the GDP as fast as we can and to really race to the bottom? For me, that's not what my goals are. So how do we have a more meaningful conversation about redefining our economy in a way that actually works for all people that are contributing to the economy in paid or unpaid current ways? So I think, yeah, we need to have just a more meaningful conversation and identify what our priorities are. And when we do that, I think nobody will think basic income is a bad idea. And on that, we will end the episode. Thanks so much for tuning in to one of my lovely Katie wonk out episodes. We haven't had one in a while. I hope you enjoyed it. Please let me know your thoughts, and let me know your thoughts on basic income too. I love this topic and am more than happy to have some meaningful conversations about it with folks. And as always, if you liked this episode, please leave us a review and follow along with the conversation on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at FemWonk. Finally, if you want to get in touch by email, you can find me at katie@femmonk.com. Thanks so much.